I'm Mark Hennick, and this is Modern Minds. Welcome to Modern Minds, a podcast for the Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Health Network. I'm Mark Hennick. In this episode, we're going to be talking about teen mental health. Now, a bit later, I'll be speaking with New York Times bestselling author of The Emotional Lives of Teenagers, Dr. Lisa Damore. I'm also going to chat with Connecticut Senator and mental health advocate Chris Murphy. But I don't want to take away any time from my very first guest, who is, without exaggeration, a titan in the child and adolescent mental health space. Dr. Daniel Siegel is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine, and he's the founding co-director of the Mindful Awareness Research Center, also at UCLA. Dr. Siegel is the best-selling author of at least 14 books, including Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain, and his most recent, Interconnected, Me Plus We, as the Integration of Self, Identity, and Belonging.
Hi there.
So there's been a lot of media coverage lately about the mental health challenges that teens are facing. And I want to get your thoughts on how we can help with that. But, you know, first, having read a number of your books, I thought we could start with a little conversation about attachment. You know, it seems like we stop talking about attachment after the first 5 years, even the first 3 years. So could you give us a little bit more of an idea of the importance of that bond and how it extends and evolves, not just in childhood, but throughout the teenage years as well?
Absolutely. Well, attachment is a word we use in science for the relationship between a child and their caregiver. So that could be the parent, it could be a relative, another individual. We actually can have a few attachment figures in our lives. But that need for connection to others doesn't just stay in childhood. It's present throughout our lives, actually, and we're extremely social beings. So, for example, during adolescence, we need our parents, we need other caregivers, and we start transferring that close connection to our peers. And it's that disconnection during the pandemic that may have been an important feature for why we're seeing so much distress now, because attachment relationships basically not only help us feel better because we're connected, but we learn how to shape our own internal world, how to know who we are through these important relationships. And when we don't have them, we can feel very disconnected and despairing. So attachment lasts throughout our lifespans.
Now, so much of, I think, the conversation around teenagers who are struggling, it seems to start with the premise that there's something quote unquote wrong with them, you know, that there's a neurobiological or a psychological defect of sorts, and we need to find a cure for it. I'm going to put a pin in that externalization of the problem for a second, because what I really want to talk about is how we can talk about the interconnected role that parents have to play in their kids' struggles and their joys for that matter, but without making it seem like we're blaming or shaming parental behavior as the cause of their kids' mental illness. You know, how can we talk about the other causes that are not all in the teenager's head?
Absolutely. Well, I think speaking about the teenager's head, what we've learned in the last 20 years or so is that there's a remodeling process that goes on in the adolescent brain. And it's this change in the connections, that initially a loss in connections that's needed to actually to refine the specialization of the brain. And then as the later periods of the adolescent time of life go on, you have increased connections with laying down of something called myelin. So when we say remodeling, it's this pruning down of existing connections and this laying down of new strengths among the connected neurons. Now, we say all that because there's an essence of adolescence I talk about in a book called Brainstorm that I wrote actually for adolescents themselves, so they could understand what's their emotional spark. So emotions are more intense. And so that does not mean pathology. It just means passion. Yet there is a downside to this because they can get overwhelmed by their own emotions. And if we're going to develop an emotional, quote, disorder like depression or manic depressive illness, it's most likely to have its first onset during the adolescent period. So we need to distinguish this emotional spark from emotional disorder. And that's an important distinction to make. Then we have the social engagement where adolescents may start to push against us and go to their peers more. And across all cultures, that's a natural way where adolescents begin to establish their social connectivity. The downside is you can give up morality to gain membership. So we need to support adolescents in thinking clearly, kind of driven by an internal compass on how to properly set up their emotional connections. The pandemic has made that also very difficult. The N of essence, this is an acronym, is novelty seeking. And this is where an adolescent is really trying on new things. And that's for a number of different neurological reasons this is happening. But the behavioral manifestation is they can be taking risks, that's the downside, that actually literally endanger them or their peers. And so helping adolescents during this period, which is filled with risk, that's necessary for them to take to learn about the world, is an important part of how we as adults can support them. And then finally, the CE is creative explorations. You know, the big new ways of approaching things come from adolescent minds. And so we need to see this and support this rather than see it as a pathology. So that's it. That's adolescence in a nutshell, Mark, when you think about the remodeling and what it does and how we should be careful to distinguish between disorder and development.
Right. And I mean, teenagers, or any of us for that matter, we're not just brains in jars. We live in intraconnected and interconnected worlds. And I think our parents, of course, as kids and as teenagers, are critical parts of that world. And there's the idea for a very long time now, popularized by Winnicott, of the good enough parent. And that, for me, evokes the idea that we all fall down. And in fact, that perfection arguably is counterproductive when it comes to parenting. The arguments, the fights, the disagreements, the mismatch and repair. I mean... How does that actually strengthen the bond with the teenager?
Well, exactly. Well, first of all, what it shows the teenager is that you are human, that you're human, not perfect. And in recognizing that we may have a direction we're aiming for, but we don't always get there, we can accept that sometimes we make mistakes, we make blunders. And in all the parenting books that I write, I try to write about my own, sometimes to my own children's dismay. They said, why are you letting the world know what a jerk you can be? And I said, that's exactly what I want to do. They said, what's wrong with you? You know, which is a good question for them to ask. But it's not because I'm writing about this, because as you're pointing out, Mark, you know, we are really given the opportunity to be present as parents, not perfect. Now, what that means, though, is that if we do make a blunder, we want to go back and make a repair to that ruptured connection. And what that does is it teaches adolescents that, okay, if they make mistakes, they can say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that, but I see the error of my ways. Can we reconnect and start over again? And that's what the value of us doing it as parents is. It actually teaches our adolescents how to do that too.
I think that it's so easy as parents, also as teens, as just anybody, to get all tangled up in your own stuff, right? We get on these trips, these power trips, anger trips, whether it's grief or self-righteousness, whatever. You often don't even know that you're on a trip until you come back home from it again, back to your emotional home, that is. So, you know, when you get into that kind of entanglement or enmeshment with a teenager who themselves is dealing with a lot of powerful emotions, in those moments, how do you remember to be in it but not of it? Yeah. How do you extricate yourself so that way you can be a more calm parent?
You know, that's a beautiful way to say it, to be you know, in it but, you know, of it but not totally swallowed up by it. You know, there are a number of things you could do. In the basic notion of keep the lines of communication open, we have to do exactly what you're saying, Mark. We have to start with our inner life. So I actually recommend to parents to make sure themselves they do. There was a book I wrote called Parenting from the Inside Out with Mary Hartzell. And it gives parents a guide to say, you know, what was my own journey when I was a kid that I learned certain strategies of dealing with what I was immersed in. And then what that does is it builds on the attachment research finding that the best way you can show up for your child so they can have what's called a secure attachment is not what happened to you, but how you've come to make sense of what happened to you. Now, that finding, when I heard it from the research from Mary Main and colleagues at Berkeley, was so empowering because what it means is you can work with parents, whether it's clinically or in workshops or in educational settings like we're in right now, and say, the real path you can take to show up is to first make sense of your own childhood history. What did you go through? What happened to you? What do you remember about it? How did you adapt to what happened to you? And how have all those experiences and adaptations to those experiences stayed with you now as an adult? And how are they shaping, for good or not so good, your parenting now? And then how would you like to be? So that making sense process is the number one thing to start with. And that's what I offer to parents, not only with Parenting from the Inside Out, but with a tool where you can learn to reflect inwardly called the Wheel of Awareness. And it's something else parents can do to retain that calmness, even in the face of a storm.
We parent as we were parented in many ways, whether we recognize it or not. I think it's easy for parents to fall into this trap of fixer fixation. You know, my kid is broken and I want to fix them. And you desperately want to help them because that's your heart out there walking around outside your body, suffering, struggling, stumbling. And it can feel powerless. Yet I think at the same time, sometimes that clinging seems to create more friction between parents and teens. Sometimes it can alienate and push people away when, at least this is how I felt when I was a teen struggling. Maybe I'm just putting too much of my own stuff into this, but you know, it feels like you're being treated like a project rather than really getting to know your kid. So I guess I'm wondering about the role of acceptance here, not resignation or giving up or throwing up your hands, but how do you really practice that radical acceptance with your kid and their suffering and their hurting and all of it?
Yeah, it's such a great question, especially in light of the reports that have just come out about the really terrifying increase in depression, anxiety, addiction, self-harming behavior, and suicide among youth, including adolescents. So This is a very serious moment in the United States with these really huge epidemic proportions of childhood mental distress. So what can we say about it in terms of your question? You know, I think it's a really important issue, the idea of acceptance. In many ways, there's a fundamental process called integration, where you both differentiate on the one hand and link on the other. And so the pathway to the acceptance you're talking about, Mark, is really to look deeply. And all my books, including the parenting books, are about integration, really. And so for a parent, what does that mean? That means you may expect your adolescent to be a certain way and try to make them be that way, rather than seeing who they actually are. So you're differentiating and then linking by keeping the channels of communication open. So often, you know, I'm a family therapist. And often when I see families where there's struggles with adolescents, it's where one of the parents or both are really having a hard time differentiating their own expectations or their own experience in their childhood from what this individual, their adolescent, is going through right now. When we can tease that apart and recognize the essence of adolescence we spoke about, then it's really helpful. And the parents can brainstorm also. With that as a guide, you can see, okay, I see these are the fundamental changes of adolescence. When I allow differentiation to emerge and yet set up channels of communication, so linkages there, often what before seemed like a disorder turns out to just be a moment of disconnection. That allows acceptance to really be fully there because then you're seeing who your child really is. Now, sometimes something is emerging that actually is not about the relationship with you, the parent. It's about disconnection from peers or spending too much time on social media, for example, getting a feeling of missing out or a feeling of inadequacy. And as we said, because of this remodeling, some of the major psychiatric disorders can emerge during this period of brain remodeling. And so we need to also realize that sometimes it's not about our relationship with our adolescent. There's something else going on. And sometimes getting professional help is really essential to distinguish, is this just a developmental phase or is this actually a disorder that's emerging that could use professional support? So we don't want to freak people out, but we do want to honor that adolescence is a period of a lot of changes. And so if you begin feeling like there's something really going in a wrong direction, acceptance is good, but also accepting that this is what's going on and seeking help can be a part of that acceptance. Acceptance is really seeing things for how they actually are. It doesn't mean doing nothing.
Hmm. And you mentioned some of the really concerning statistics, of course, that we've been seeing. So I guess I'm just wondering, before we wrap up, do you think that this is a case of different generations, you know, not knowing what's going on with younger generations? That's a perennial problem. Or is there something different now? Are the kids okay now?
It's a great question. You have these great questions, Mark. What I would say is this, and I tried to talk about this in this new book, Interconnected. In the United States, especially, more than any other country, actually, we have a very individualistic stance about life that, you know, you're born into a body and who you are is your body and that's yourself, that's you. You know, you should take that body and make sure it does what it needs to do. This individualism is actually quite a conflict with a deeper biological reality that we're incredibly social. So that when you then add to the adolescent period of the brain remodeling, the whole exposure to social media, and now 3 years into a pandemic, you have isolation. So these messages that you're supposed to be okay by yourself, but then you get on social media and you see how everyone is curating these images that look like they're all so happy when they're actually not, but it appears that way. And then you can't reach out and develop these friendships because of the virus that's keeping you separated. And now parents are stressed out. And all these things happening in the world with social injustice, with climate crisis, just to name two. Well, the polarization and misinformation, that's a third one. All these, what you call pandemics, are making this different, I think, from any other period. We've never faced a moment in looking, for example, at the climate issue, where repeatedly we're getting messages in the news from panels of scientists that are saying we have about a 10-year period to alter the way we live in modern culture, or it will be past a tipping point. Kids pick that up. Children and adolescents are picking that up. And we need to give them an empowerment to be able to participate in doing something about that. I think this isolated solo self view of who the individual is as separate is actually creating some of this problem with even the climate crisis. So it's going to be a win-win situation if we can really bring our relationality, our connection, our social identities together to work together. But I think this is a serious moment. It isn't just, oh, every generation is like this. We've never seen mental suffering as high as it is now in our youth, ever. And that's not just, oh, people are alone, let's get them back in school. There's a lot of things going on, and we need to really work together to deal with this crisis.
Well, and thankfully, we have people like you who are offering some really insightful advice and strategies to help with that. Dr. Dan Siegel, your latest book is Interconnected, Me Plus We, and the Integration of Self-Identity and Belonging. Thanks so much for joining me on Modern Minds today, Dan.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
We're going to be right back with Dr. Lisa Damor and Senator Chris Murphy right after this.
Mental health is health. At the Institute of Living, we are pioneers in mental health. And we have been for 200 years. We have an ambition to transform mental health services while co-designing these services with those whom we serve. Together, we can reduce stigma, address discrimination, and increase access to care.
Welcome back to Modern Minds. My next guest is Dr. Lisa Damore. Dr. Damore co-hosts the Ask Lisa podcast. She writes about adolescence for the New York Times, and she appears as a regular contributor to CBS News. Dr. Damore is the author of formerly two New York Times bestselling books, Untangled, Guiding Teenage Girls Through the Seven Transitions into Adulthood, and Under Pressure, Confronting the Epidemic of Stress and Anxiety in Girls. Now she's a three-time New York Times bestselling author. Her bestseller, The Emotional Lives of Teenagers, Raising Connected, Capable, and Compassionate Adolescents, is available now everywhere. Here's my conversation with Dr. Lisa Damore on the Modern Minds podcast. Dr. Lisa, thank you so much for joining me on the Modern Minds podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So we're talking about adolescent mental health, teenagers. You know, you've been talking about teens for more than 25 years of your own professional career. So I thought there'd be no better guest to understand what's going on, especially post-pandemic, with America's teenagers. I've seen studies showing that there are increasing rates of hospitalizations, of depression. There's perennial concerns around social media use, around substance abuse and use. So I'm hoping that you can unpack some of these issues for us in the short time we have together today. So let's get started with what you think are some of the most common emotional challenges that teenagers are facing today, and if they're any different than they have been historically.
So being a teenager and raising a teenager has always been hard. This is in some ways the value of having practiced so long before the pandemic arrived, is that my baseline understanding of what it means to go through adolescence is that it's a challenging time. The problem, of course, is that the pandemic made everything harder. The pandemic really landed on teenagers in a very particular way. Teenagers have two jobs, which is to become increasingly independent and to spend as much time with their friends as possible. And the pandemic really got in the way of both of those. So we have always seen a fair bit of ups and downs and vulnerability in adolescence. And then in the wake of the pandemic, we are trying to contend with a mental health crisis in teenagers, are trying to up the workforce to take care of their needs. And in my work, I'm trying to provide parents and the adults immediately around adolescents with strategies and understanding that can help them support teens under any conditions, with or without a mental health concern.
I think one of the persistent misunderstandings, maybe, but it's also a genuine confusion, is if something is clinically a problem versus if it's quote unquote just regular teenage stuff, right? So what are some of the signs and symptoms that a parent, a teacher, another significant person in a teenager's life should look for that there might actually be something more serious happening or something more substantial happening?
So what I want to start with is what they should not be worried about, which is if a teenager becomes upset. That on its own is not a sign that something is really wrong. Teenagers have very powerful emotions. They feel negative emotions very powerfully. They also feel positive emotions very powerfully. And it is the nature of adolescence. It has always been the nature of adolescence where teenagers have pretty pronounced ups and downs. So if a teenager is having ups and downs and making it through their day and getting done with the things they need to do, that is not actually grounds for concern. What I want people to be on the lookout for are a few things. One is, if it's not ups and downs, if a teenager's mood goes to a concerning place and stays there, that we become concerned about. Another thing we want to watch out for is if a teenager's mood is getting in the way of their lives, that they are so anxious or sad, that they are not going to school or they're not spending time with friends. Teenagers will have moods, they will come and go, but they shouldn't disrupt daily living. And then the last thing we want to watch for is what I call costly coping, which is where teenagers are using strategies to feel better that come with a price tag. So whether it's substance abuse or tearing at the fabric of relationships or somehow harming or being a threat to themselves, that is also grounds for concern.
So, you know, we talk a lot about coping strategies, I think, and all of us, even as adults, can do a better job of learning how to better cope, especially with our emotions so laid bare over the course of the pandemic, where you really I think all of us felt unexpected things over the course of the pandemic. So then how do we help teenagers to build resilience and to build more positive coping mechanisms when sometimes their adult parents themselves don't even necessarily have those skills.
No, it's true. I mean, one of the most important sort of lessons in parenting is don't talk about it, be about it, right? It's really what we show kids more than what we tell kids that shapes their behavior. But one thing that's really useful as adults walk up to this question of teenagers and their moods is to be really clear about what mental health is. So mental health is actually not about feeling good. It's not about feeling calm or relaxed. I mean, we want people to feel those things from time to time, but as psychologists, that's not our measure of mental health. Mental health is about two things. One is having feelings that fit the moment you're in, the context you're in. So even if it's a painful emotion, if it makes sense, we see it as evidence of mental health. But then the second part of the definition of mental health goes right to coping. It's how the coping happens. Is it happening in a way that brings relief and does no harm? Or is it happening in a way that brings relief, but there's a cost attached? So let's consider a boy who gets his heart broken, right? Which happens. If he's very sad in that moment, we would not see that on its own as a sign of a concern. We'd actually see that as evidence that he works perfectly. What we would want to observe is, how does he cope? So does he reach out to friends? Does he put on his sad playlist to get some of the sad feelings out? Does he go for a run to help himself feel better? If that's how he's coping, that is all adaptive and healthy and really everything we could hope for. Mm. Instead, if he moves, sorry.
No, please go ahead. Finish your thought. I cut you off.
If he goes down a road of coping in a way that's destructive, right? May give him relief, but be destructive. You know, smoking a lot of marijuana until the feeling wears off, or getting online and being rude to the person who broke his heart. That's where we would only have a grounds for concern in those conditions.
Mm. Now, you know, my background was partly in child development. And in that space, we talk a lot about co-regulation, that you have to check in with yourself before you can, you know, necessarily help somebody else. I feel like in the conversation around teenagers, we almost forget that language around co-regulation and the alternative, co-escalation. So then what's your advice for parents especially, because parents are on the front lines of tumultuous teenage years. What's your advice for leveling yourself instead of getting all tangled up in the hurricane that sometimes is adolescence?
So what we want to remember is that our kids look to us for indication of how upset they themselves should be. And this starts as soon as they're toddlers, really, even. And as parents of toddlers, we tend to be pretty good at managing this. So one of the things that's always true about toddlers is if they fall down and scrape their knee, first they will look at their knee, and then they will look at the parent's face to try to get a sense of how serious the injury is. And as parents of toddlers, we're pretty good at this. We're pretty good at saying, like, oh, you're okay, come to me, we'll clean you up, even if inside we're feeling stirred up. Because we know that with our toddler, if we have a strong reaction, our toddler is going to become very frightened. So what we need to do as parents of teenagers is to plug back into those good instincts that we had raising toddlers. And so when our teenager comes home and says, I messed up this test, or I hate school, or, you know, any variety of things, they are looking to us to get a sense of how big a deal this is. And our job in those moments is to try to be a steady presence, to be interested and engaged, but not reactive. Even if on the inside we're feeling stirred up, and that's okay. You can't always prevent that. But I always think, like, we have to manage our face the same way we did with toddlers.
Yeah. You know, I've spoken on this show before and in many other venues about the fact that I was a troubled teen. I had a very tumultuous teenage period myself. And I remember distinctly when I was going through many of my quite acute psychiatric challenges in that time, not believing what anybody would tell me about my struggles, right? That's that lack of insight, that partly that's an adolescent thing. It's partly a symptom of the struggles that I was facing at that time. But also, I think personally, part of it was that I just really didn't want to talk about my problems and only my problems all the time, as though we were always trying to fix me, you know? So how can a parent or a teacher or anybody else work with a kid who isn't necessary, maybe they don't have insight into some of the struggles that they're facing, or maybe they just don't want to deal with it. Maybe they want to talk about something they like or something they enjoy instead of just their struggles all the time. How do you manage that boundary, I guess, with a teenager who doesn't necessarily want to engage with what they're struggling with?
Well, there's a few things here. One is, we need to remember to treat teenagers as the whole and complex human beings that they are. That so often in the discourse around teenagers, the idea of what a teenager is gets flattened, right? That they're just, you know, in trouble or problematic or on social media too much. And we lose sight of the fact that this is probably one of the richest, most, I think personally, enthralling phases of development that happens at any point in life. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, teenagers are extremely sensitive to how they are perceived by adults, individual adults. And so they can detect at a very great distance an adult who is ready to stereotype them, pigeonhole them, see them in a very two-dimensional way. They can also detect adults who can see them as whole and complex and are interested in them as a complicated person. And so what I would say to adults is you want to remember teenagers are got a lot going on. And one of the ways I think about them is that all teenagers have two sides. They have a immature, sometimes impulsive, sometimes, you know, risk-taking, concrete in their thinking side. And they also have a philosophical, broad-minded, forward-looking, brilliant side. And in my experience, the side of the teenager that you speak to is the side that shows up for the conversation. And so in my clinical work, I am always talking with teenagers about maybe even destructive behavior they're engaged in by trying to engage the part of them that is probably worried about this or curious about why they're acting this way. And so I'll give you an example of how I do this. I had an adolescent girl in my practice who is impulsive and also a terrific kid. And she came in and told me about a very out of control party that she had been at. And I said to her, okay, but what is a smart girl like you doing at a party like that? Like, we got to figure that out. Teenagers will always rise if you treat them in that way.
Mm-hmm. With respect and with allowing space for who they are and the differences that they bring to the table, you know, because there are very real differences between the teenage brain and the adult brain, I think, that needs to be honored. And, you know, on that front, I mean, let's talk a little bit about some of those differences. There's been conversations had before around cannabis use, for example, in the teenage years. This is not a new phenomenon by any means, but there has been a good bit of research to show that during that critical period of brain development during adolescence, that it could be quite problematic. Where do you stand on the use of cannabis or any other substance during the teenage years?
Well, what we do know is that it impacts the brain differently because the brain is in a period of development and transition. And so we have very good data showing that over time, chronic use can change the developing brain in a lasting way, that it doesn't necessarily repair when the cannabis use stops. We also are dealing with much more potent cannabis than we have had in the past. And the other thing we're dealing with, and there's some really quite extraordinary research on this, as cannabis becomes legal, for adults. But again, the age decisions that are being made on the legal side don't match the biological information we have in terms of when it's safer to use cannabis. The norming of cannabis use, the number of dispensaries that are in a community actually is connected to dropping ages at which kids experiment with cannabis. So one of the things we want to be mindful of as we move into an environment where cannabis is increasingly legal, which I'm agnostic on that for adults. There's no reason to think it's something that we need to be particularly, it's not my department, I guess is what I would say. But what we do know for teenagers is that when there's a lot of exposure to cannabis in a normed way, it changes the age at which initiation occurs for some teenagers.
Sure, because it's so salient around them. It's around them all the time, especially if their friends are doing it. You mentioned before, you know, the power of relationships, and in particular, peer relationships. And I've heard conflicting information on this. Are parents, of course, parents are important to their teenagers, but are they the most important figure in a teenager's life? Or is it indeed their peers? You know, I've heard different parenting advice on this point.
You know, it's one of those extraordinarily complex things that depending on the door you walk in, you're going to come to a different conclusion. But here's what I will say. We have incredibly strong evidence that when it comes to adolescent mental health, teenage mental health, the most powerful force for good are working relationships with caring adults. So of course, teenagers care about their peers. Of course, they're interested in what their peers are up to. They want to have strong connections, and they should. But part of the work that I do, or the reason I do my work, is to try to strengthen the relationship between the teenagers and the adults right around them, because we know that that is the single most powerful force on behalf of youth mental health.
Mm. Now, we're coming to the end of our time together, but I do want to ask you about the work that you do with teenagers. You've mentioned it a couple of times here, and I think there's still a lot of stigma around psychotherapy in particular and psychotherapeutic type of work in a way that, you know, I think that the stigma has lessened for medication, although is certainly still there. I think that there's still a lot of stigma around psychotherapy. So break that down for us, if you can, a little bit. What is the role of therapy? When should you bring in a therapist to help your teenager? And how can you normalize that for them as a parent, that it's okay to go to therapy, that it doesn't need the stigma that it sometimes has?
So we want to get professional support on board anytime a teenager is relying on destructive coping, or when a mood is getting in the way of their daily life. And certainly, of course, if there's any concern about their safety, we want to make sure that there is a professional who's helping. But it's hard sometimes to introduce this idea to teenagers. And one of the things I remember learning early in my training, it was said to me by a supervisor, and I didn't entirely believe it at the time. A supervisor said to me, "You have to remember with teenagers that they all secretly worry that they're crazy." Those were her words. And I remember at the time thinking, is that really true? I don't know about that. But I actually have come to think that that's true, that there's such powerful emotionality that seems to come out of nowhere for teenagers, even though it's neurologically normal, that it can be very unsettling. And so then when somebody says, you know what, you actually need to be talking to a clinician, I think it can actually deepen that concern. So when I am helping parents get their kid to therapy, the kind of language I encourage them to use is to say to teenagers, look, what you are up against is enormous. You deserve more support than you have right now. Or you are facing a depression that is just absolutely the upshot of a biology that has spun out of control. If you broke your leg, we would take you to the doctor. You are having a biological reaction that is getting in the way of your life. We're going to take you to a clinician who can help you get better.
Dr. Lisa Damore, the book is The Emotional Lives of Teenagers. You also host a podcast, Ask Lisa, The Psychology of Parenting. Thank you so much for joining me on Modern Minds today.
Thank you for having me.
Chris Murphy is the Democratic senator from Connecticut, and he's a longstanding advocate for mental health. In 2016, Murphy worked across the aisle to pass landmark mental health legislation, the Mental Health Reform Act, with Republican Senator Bill Cassidy. Last year, Murphy and Cassidy came back together to reauthorize and improve the programs in the Mental Health Reform Act, with a particular goal of addressing COVID-19's devastating impact on children and youth mental health. He joins me now on Modern Minds. Senator Murphy, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Senator, a Pew Research study last fall found that the number one concern that U.S. parents express about their kids' well-being is their mental health. So beyond the obvious illness and death that was caused by COVID-19, now that we have a little bit of critical distance from it, what do you think the pandemic did to the minds of American youth?
Well, I saw it firsthand. I'm a parent of two boys, one a middle schooler, 14-year-old, another a fifth grader, 11 years old. And you know, my boys had all the supports necessary to be able to survive the pandemic, parents who supported them and helped them through that experience. And yet there was no way for them to become unaffected by it. And you have a generation of kids who lived through several years of really crippling uncertainty, right? We know developing minds benefit from certainty, from structure, and they had nothing but uncertainty and lack of structure. We know now that distance learning was not terribly effective. And so you have kids who are showing back up at school with tremendous learning loss, far behind where they should be, often behind their classmates. And there's anxiety that comes with that. And then especially for younger kids who had never had the experience of socialization and learning how to interact with peers, especially lower income kids, they lost those critical social, emotional sort of formative years. And so you're hearing these stories of crisis from kindergarten and first grade teachers who say, we can't teach a single thing in our classrooms because all we're doing is starting from scratch to teach kids how to deal with each other. So I've seen it firsthand. I've seen it through my kids' friends, but I also have seen it as a policymaker. And it, of course, exists at a moment where we have a broader crisis, the one that you mentioned happening with young adults in this country. The pandemic just made it all worse.
Now, during the pandemic, I mean, many of us, but especially teens, I think, relied on social media not only for our news, but to stay connected with others, sometimes to the exclusion of any other means, because that's all that we had. But it seems to have had a bit of a paradoxical effect for teens in particular. It connects them, but it also further isolates them in a way, too. So, you know, I've seen some of the work that you've done on social media. Do you think that social media has been a net negative for teen mental health, or is it a tool that can be used more effectively?
Yeah, I think the jury is probably still out, but my guess is that it has been a net negative. I think what we're learning is that online connection is not a substitute for in-person connection. What we're also learning is that boys and girls experience social media differently. Boys, I think, tend to use social media more as a means of connection, right? Boys are more often online gaming with each other. I'm not suggesting that's, you know, healthier than in-person cooperative experiences, but girls tend to do less of that sort of, you know, real-time social interaction and more of the social media scrolling that breeds envy and unfortunately can, you know, lead some girls into darker places. So I think we have to understand, you know, that not everybody experiences social media the same. I think we're coming to the conclusion that online connection is not the same as in-person connection. And we should do something about that. I think it's time for us to take steps to protect our kids better from the corrosive effects of social media. But at the same time, to not put all of our eggs in that basket. I think it would be foolish for us to believe that the very real crisis that has happened for our kids, especially our teenagers today, is simply a direct line result of access and exposure to social media. There's something, I think, deeper and more fundamental that's happening in American culture today. It's not just that we're all online and that's making us unhappy.
This is a really good point, because whether it's social media or the pandemic stuff, these things may exacerbate problems that that kids were already facing anyway, right? So I think that when you look at the American healthcare system, there's already some major pre-existing systemic conditions, to call them that, that made accessing child and youth mental health services harder than it needed to be for too many people anyway. So what have you been seeing have been the biggest barriers that teens and their parents, who are often the ones getting the care for their kids, what are the biggest barriers that they're facing in accessing mental health care?
Well, let me say something about that, and then let me back it up a little bit. So there are, as you know, enormous barriers, and we're trying to solve those barriers with public policy. One of the barriers is the mistake we made back in the 1960s when we shut down the mental health institutions to build a system of mental health that was completely separate from the rest of our healthcare system. That was a mistake. We shouldn't have done that, because now you go into your primary care provider and you will find that they are pretty woefully trained on diseases and maladies of the brain. They're just going to refer you out to a behavioral health provider who is not integrated with that primary care practice by and large. And so to me, we've got to make primary care physicians behavioral health practitioners. We've got to integrate behavioral health with the health of the rest of the body and build a continuous, uninterrupted system of healthcare. That's one of the biggest barriers, is that if you want to get care for your kid's brain, you got to go into a whole different healthcare system. The second barrier is insurance. There's just still insurance discrimination happening all over the country. This is what Senator Cassidy and I spend a lot of time working on, trying to require insurance companies to cover more of mental illness coverage. But all of that being said, I frankly, having spent a lot of my life working on mental health care, I mean, this has been one of the signature issues of my career. I am more and more convinced that that cannot be our primary answer, that we have to get at the root causes of this unhealthiness. And social media is part of it. But as I referenced, there are other pieces of that conversation. And I think if our entire conversation is just about treating the illness instead of trying to understand why kids' brain activity has changed, what has made them unhealthier, what has pushed more kids into crisis, then we're not helping kids in the way that we should.
Now, I noticed in the pieces of the Mental Health Reform Act that you co-authored with Senator Cassidy, you, in addition to the healthcare stuff, like you're talking about, there is a strong focus on community-based approaches as well. Is that your effort to address some of these underlying root causes? And what are some of those other root causes that you're talking about?
Well, I think we can back a lot of sort of the crisis facing America into a conversation about what we value. We've always been a country that obsesses about entrepreneurship and individualism, right? That's the genius of this nation, that we are all strong individuals. We believe in pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. But over the course of our history, we have always combined that with a real sense of community, a belief that we are doing well if our community is doing well, and that we all have a responsibility to lift up our community. I think we've lost a lot of that. I think this country is becoming hyper-individualistic, and everyone's conception of personal health is now almost exclusively inward-focused and not focused on the health of the community and the health of neighbors. I don't think that has helped our teens, and I think it has caused them to I think obsess over how they believe they don't measure up to their peers, how they don't meet a standard that they see online. It disconnects us from each other, because when we don't value those connections, when we don't value how well all of us are doing together, we just sort of pull inwards. So I think we've got to build a culture in which we just care more about how our communities are doing, that we actually feel happier when our communities are doing better. There's a sort of hyper-narcissism, a hyper-individualism that is, I think, plaguing our society today. And that's partially a result of public policy that doesn't support communities, that doesn't support community institutions, that doesn't support the mechanisms by which we connect to each other. And I think if we focused more on building those connections, we would help us rebuild a sense of health. It's not just about our individual health. It's also about our collective health. And I think that'd be positive for kids.
In the Mental Health Reform Act, you also have a strong focus on schools. And we spend so much time, I think, in healthcare talking about personal healthcare decisions and how healthcare decisions for kids are in the domain of parents. So then what are the role of schools and of teachers in safeguarding the mental health of teenagers?
Well, I think we have failed to make a decision as to whether we want schools to be a place of universal access to mental health care, or we want schools to be places where illness or crisis is identified, and then we refer out to the community. We have no system of school-based mental health care in this state. In Connecticut, you know, it's just a matter of chance as to whether the school your kid is in has licensed behavioral health professionals, or those professionals are to be found in the community. I would rather us just make a decision. Either every school is going to have licensed clinical professionals treating mental health, or no schools are. And all those systems are going to be in the community. And what the schools are supposed to be doing is identifying the kids who need to be connected to the community and connecting them there. I think by failing to make a decision, we are driving parents crazy, because they do not know what the system is. They do not know. You know, one of their kids' schools has professionals inside the school. Another one of their kids' schools doesn't. It's just making a confusing system even more confusing. So either let's do it universally, or let's move all the professionals into the community and let's put schools in the business of identifying.
Now, so many of our treatments as usual in the mental health care space are reactive and problem focused. And you mentioned, you know, responding to different crises. And that's a necessary part of the healthcare pipeline. But it can also sometimes feel like we're just always catching up, like we're always behind the eight ball of always responding to different crises. What do you think that legislators can do to help put in place programs that potentially prevent mental health problems from happening in the first place in children and youth?
Well, I think first and foremost, just talk to parents and kids. I mean, understand, you know, how they're feeling, and then be, you know, be bold enough to sort of take some steps back to think about the ways in which our society is ordered, and to think about the ways that the breakdown of our communities, the sort of commodification of everything in our society, the evisceration of our downtowns, the places that where we used to build community, understand all of that has had an impact on our mental health collectively, and that we've got to build healthier communities. And doing that is really multi-systemic.
Finally, Senator, that Pew survey that I mentioned at the top of our conversation, one of the other findings from it was that parents are realizing that it's harder to be a parent than they thought that it was going to be, especially coming through the pandemic, you know? And it's incredibly hard to care for somebody who needs extra care, especially if that person is your child. So for parents who are caring for a teen who might be struggling with their mental health, what words of comfort or hope could you offer them in these really challenging times?
Well, it is difficult. And all I can say is that there are people like me who have teenagers and have young kids that are engaged every day in the business of trying to make this system more coherent. One of the things that I really believe in is care coordinators. I think that, you know, more parents need individuals, you know, either housed at the hospital or, I think more appropriately, housed at the insurance company you deal with, whose sole job is to walk you through the connections that you need to make in the healthcare space for your child. We need more case management, more care coordination, and a lot of us are trying to work on ways to make that more accessible.
Senator Chris Murphy, Democratic Senator from Connecticut, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Before I let you go, I want you to hear from just one more person. Brian, over to you.
Thank you, Mark. We continue the conversation of spotting and treating mental health conditions in children and adolescents, a very important topic. Joining me now to discuss is Dr. Mara DeMaio, Director of Child and Adolescent Services for Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living in Hartford, Connecticut. So how common is mental illness when it comes to children and adolescents?
Well, approximately 4 million or 21% of youth between the ages of 9 and 17 experience some sort of mental illness that interferes with their functioning at home, at school, and with peers. And when we talk about mental illness, we talk about disorders such as depression and anxiety. About half of all mental illnesses develop before the age of 14.
Wow.
And what is even more striking is our suicide rates. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for youth between the ages of 10 and 14, and the third leading cause of death for individuals between the ages of 15 and 24. The suicide risk is even higher for our more vulnerable population, such as the LGBTQ plus population. And 90% of individuals who die by suicide experience a mental health disorder at some point in their life. Unfortunately, only 20% of those are identified and treated for mental illness, youth. And some of the factors that contribute to that are stigma, lack of access, or just lack of resources.
Wow, that is alarming statistics that people need to be mindful of. So in your opinion, what are some of the biggest challenges that children and adolescents are facing in today's world? Because we know there's a lot of them.
Absolutely. I would say the two challenges that stand out to me the most, the first would be access to social media. Youth have a lot of access to social media, and that increases the chances of online bullying. Kids will say things and do things that they would not do in person. And that's in addition to the bullying that is really typical of childhood and adolescence. In addition to that, kids are comparing themselves to idealistic and unrealistic images online, and are also spending more time online and on social media and decreasing social interactions in person, which can negatively impact mental health. Secondly, the pandemic.
Yeah.
We are increasingly seeing the mental health consequences of the pandemic on youth. Social isolation from distance learning, school closures, limited interactions with peers, limited supports from schools, not being able to engage in normal milestones such as graduation, proms, school dances, all, you know, negatively impact the mental health of youth. We've actually seen in a recent report that mental health claims have doubled during the pandemic.
Wow.
And those are just ones that are reported. And the mental health, you know, concerns are exacerbated for our more vulnerable populations, again, such as those with pre-existing mental health conditions, LGBTQ youth, and children of color.
So, you know, we know that it's important to treat children and adolescents who are going through these issues. So if you can, sort of take me through what's available with the Institute of Living to help this population.
We have a wide range of services. We have two inpatient units for children and adolescents. We have a partial hospital program, an intensive outpatient program, an extended day treatment program. Within those, we have specialized tracks, such as advanced services for adolescents with psychosis. We have an outpatient clinic for children and adolescents. We have the web schools, which are therapeutic day schools. We have Access Mental Health, which is a psychiatric consultation service for PCPs in the community. And we just opened the Mary W. Parker Autism Center for youth and adults diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder.
So a lot of resources out there. And that brings me to my final question. What advice would you have for parents or grandparents out there who may notice that a child or a teen is going through some mental health issues? They may be at their wit's end. They don't know what to do. What advice would you have for them?
I would tell them to reach out to anyone, really. Reach out to a mental health professional, reach out to a school counselor, a peer, a family member. But early intervention and identification is really, really crucial in promoting recovery, decreasing the chances of serious symptoms from emerging in adulthood, and increasing the chance of functioning in work, life, school, with peers. So reach out. It is really important.
And as you mentioned, those suicide rates, there's so many things. You never want it to get to that point. And so reaching out for help is obviously key. So Dr. DeMaio, thank you so much. A lot of great information, information that could be life-saving. We certainly appreciate it. With that said, Mark, we'll send it back to you.
Thanks for that, Brian. Well, that's all the time we have today on the Modern Minds podcast. I've been your host, Mark Hennick. If you want to go back and listen to some of our other episodes, we've already released some on healing spaces, that is, the effect of architecture and art on how we recover. And we've had conversations as well about the recovery movement and how people like me with lived experience of a mental illness fit into that. So go back and listen to those on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio. We're on Audible. We're on Amazon. We're just about everywhere. Search up Modern Minds with Mark Hennick, and you'll be able to go back and get all those. But make sure that you hit the subscribe or the follow button on each of those, because we have lots more episodes coming up, and I want to make sure that you're the first one to get them. On upcoming episodes, we're going to be talking about psychedelics. We're going to be talking about recovery and many more current issues in the mental health care space. So until next time, this has been Modern Minds. I've been your host, Mark Hennick. Take care.